A lot to get to on golf today. Big news with the Augusta kids saying goodbye to the Masters. One of the all-time wins back in 87. The champ Larry Mize announcing this will be his final walk this April. We're going to have him on the show to discuss his Masters swan song. And as the PGA Tour heads to Pebble Beach this week, where Tom Hoagie put on a show last year down the stretch. A question you're going to want to hear the answer to. Who was more nervous that back nine, Tom or his wife Kelly, as he closed out his first PGA Tour win a year ago? Hoagie hops on the show to break it all down. Plus, Marcus Byrd, fresh off his win at the Farmers Insurance Invitational on Sunday, will tell us how he's preparing for not one, but two PGA Tour starts next month as we start golf today now.
Golf Today.
Hey there, welcome into Golf Today. We are teeing you up for the next 2 hours. I'm George Savarikas alongside Eamon Lynch. Eamon, there are certain days where we walk in the building and you kind of wonder, what are we going to talk about for 2 hours? Today would not be one of those days. More news with a story that just keeps having more legs to it.
Yeah, it really seems as though in this game you spend a lot of time, when it comes to Patrick Reed, talking about Patrick Reed on non-tournament days as the hangover from what happened on tournament days. And Patrick Reed has helped keep this story alive for yet another day.
Yeah, Patrick Reed releasing a statement. And before we get to that, just to get everyone up to speed, what transpired on Sunday at the Hero Dubai Desert Classic, Reed on the 17th, hitting driver, drivable par 4. Hard to tell by that first piece of video. We slow it down for you. His ball gets lodged in a tree. So here's where things got interesting. Reed, you see a bunch of balls in there. Reed trying to identify his ball. Instead of having to take a lost ball, go back to the tee. If he could identify his ball, he would just have to take an unplayable. So Reed told Golf Digest, you have to make sure it's your ball. How I mark my golf ball is I always put an arrow on the end of my line, because in the Pro V1, the arrow on the end stops before you can see the arrow. You can definitely see and identify the line with the arrow on the end. The rules official luckily was there to reconfirm and check it to make sure it was mine as well. But the spot shadow, they thought it was in the third tree. It actually wound up in the first tree. So Reed then added, I would have gone back to the tee if I wasn't 100% sure. So he was afforded a penalty drop for an unplayable. That was kind of the controversy that transpired. We were wondering, was Patrick the one who had identified the tree, or if there was someone else involved as far as a spotter or whatnot? So here was his statement. He said, some people love controversy, but what happened on the 17th hole at the Hero Dubai Desert Classic was not an issue. As the DP World Tour confirmed, I was not asked to identify the tree my ball struck. That was done by the ShotLink volunteers and several marshals. I was asked to describe the distinctive markings on the ball I was playing. I'm looking forward to this week's Asian Tour flagship event at Royal Greens. Eamon, your reaction to Reed's breakdown?
Well, some people do love controversy, whether it's in the Bahamas or whether it's in Carlsbad, California, or whether it's in Dubai. It does seem to follow Patrick Reed. But, you know, this is like a guy who's been accused of a bank heist who says, look, I didn't break in anywhere. The vault was opened by somebody else. I just walked on in there. And that's... you can't just come along with this. You know, there's nothing to see here. There is plenty to see here. There's at least a question over whether or not Patrick Reed finished in the correct place in this tournament, whether it was conducted properly by the European Tour rules officials. And there's still a lot of questions around that. And there was a noteworthy omission in that statement of his today. He said, I was asked to identify the markings on my ball. That part's true. But he was asked to identify his ball, period. And an easy way to identify the markings would have just pull another one out of your bag and show the rules official how tour players mark their balls. Because presumably Patrick Reed had those balls in his bag. Patrick Reed didn't do that. That would have dispelled the issue immediately, saying, OK, well, that's my ball. This is how it's marked. That matches what's in the tree. None of that actually happened there. That's why these questions continue to roll on. And Patrick Reed putting out a statement saying there's nothing to see here, everyone move along, doesn't quite cover it.
There are two things that can be true with this story. One, if you walk inside the ropes on the DP World Tour, PGA Tour, if a guy hits a tee shot that carries 290 yards, they have spotters, marshals that are going to say, oh, we think it was in that tree. Those people can be wrong from time to time. So with that circumstance, I give Patrick Reed the benefit of the doubt that he wasn't the one eagle-eyes from 290 yards out saying it was definitely the third tree and not the first tee, or first tree. Where things get a little murky, though, is the ball identification and the rules official trying to impart to Patrick saying you have to have 100% certainty it's your marking. Patrick could have, with his own conviction, thought, okay, what I'm seeing through these binoculars is my ball. But if there's any doubt whatsoever, you got to go back and re-tee. I do think that in Patrick's mind, he was 100% certain that was his ball, even though it appears after the fact with the video we've seen that he was mistaken.
I wouldn't even grant Patrick Reed that amount of grace in this situation. The context matters here. History matters. And as Patrick Reed says, some people love controversy. Well, it follows him. And if you want to dispel that controversy, if you want everything to be above board, you go back to the tee, because it's very clear Patrick Reed was not capable of 100% identifying his ball in a tree that did not contain his golf ball. That's the simple fact of the matter here. It is monstrously unlikely that Patrick Reed's golf ball ended up in that tree for him to say that with 100% certainty that he could identify the golf ball. He did nothing in the circumstances that could have aided his own position. He could and should have gone back to the tee. That would have ended the issue right there and then. But this idea that he somehow played everything above board, I think, is being generous. He put rules officials in the position where they would have had to call him out on international television and say, no, you're not telling us the truth here. Rules officials are disinclined to do that. And what we end up here with is something that's a pretty bad look for the European Tour and its rules officials, but it's perfectly on brand for Patrick Reed.
We're talking about it. We heard Brandel breaking it down on Golf Central. Inside the locker room, do you think guys are kind of raising an eyebrow, or it's a little bit of a nothing burger? What would be your guess?
I don't think it's a nothing burger. I mean, you're going to find guys in the locker room on the European Tour who already have some kind of resentment that Patrick Reed, as a LIV player, is in the event to begin with. But that's neither here nor there in this situation. It happens often enough that Patrick Reed is no longer given the benefit of the doubt anywhere. Certainly not in social media. No one's given the benefit of the doubt in social media, frankly. But in the locker room, Patrick Reed isn't given the benefit of the doubt by his players, because it happens too often where he's put people in positions where he's expected to get the benefit of the doubt.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
Week in and week out of the PGA Tour, we see players figure out a way to lose tournaments, and then you see the very elite figure out ways to win tournaments. That's what Max Homa did last Saturday at the Farmers Insurance. Birdies on 16 and 18 capped off his sixth win on the PGA Tour, second this season, and four in his native state of California.
And how did he celebrate? Well, check this out from the Monday Q info. After winning $1,566,000 at the Farmers, he showed up at the Papago Monday Skins game in Scottsdale, Arizona, shot 67, won $400. I gotta tell you, George, I feel a little sorry here for Griffin Wood. The guy who's in second place there, he won $250. You show up for your Monday Skins game, you're not expecting to have to beat the guy who just won on the PGA Tour the day before.
To quote JT Poston, who's one of my favorite follows on Twitter, play better. I mean, that's the competition you want to face in a Monday Skins. I love that Max is a man of the people, wants to stay sharp, and then wants that juice of playing in a game like that to get those type of reps away from tournament week.
To me, that's what somebody who's grounded looks like there. That's somebody who just enjoys his life, that enjoys the game, doesn't necessarily need the thrill to be playing against the best guys in the world. Because it's amazing how many tour players will not play any kind of recreational golf at all. And I know this isn't recreational golf. There's money at stake here. But they don't play unless they're being paid a large sum of money to play on PGA Tour events. There's an enjoyment has gone out of it for a lot of guys. That's not true with Max Homa. This is a guy who loves this game and looks so at ease in his life right now and where he is.
I do think it's a mix. There are certain guys who just love the action at their local club that they play at, and they have a core of PGA Tour guys or really good local scratch or plus three to plus five handicaps that they'll play with. But then you talk with other guys in their weeks off, it's like, yeah, I'd rather.
He's a little more like Arnold Palmer, who still did the shootout at Bay Hill every week. well into his 80s, Arnie was still doing that. And Max Homa has that same vibe. He's just out there for the thrill of the competition, I guess. It doesn't matter if it's 1.5 million on the tour or 400 bucks at Papago.
It is rare to see a guy in Max's 13th in the world who gets to the top 10 in the world who doesn't love competition. You really can't be one of the true elites or greats in the game unless that's something that you thrive in. Weeks that you're on the PGA Tour and weeks that you're away from the PGA Tour.
What do you think the pot is going to be like at Papago next week? Do you think there are a few more guys are going to show up there?
You would think so.
Do you think he took the 400 bucks?
I mean, 400, it's still straight cash. You're taking 400 where you can get it, Eamon.
You think Max took it home or somebody get a good tip?
I would hope that someone had a good day who was working the cart barn there at Papago. All right, let's flash back a year ago. We showed you the Jordan Spieth shot, and we thought it was going to be the Jordan Spieth show on Sunday. Tom Hoagie said, not so fast, my friend. Birdie's on three of his last five holes. That was a 4-under 68 from Hoagie. 19-under, good enough to win by two, capping it off here on the 18th. What a way not only to get your first, but to get your first over Jordan Spieth. So here are the results from Hoagie since, and he's been playing at a high level. It's today's first win on the PGA Tour. Also won the QBE shootout, unofficial victory on the PGA Tour with Sahith Theegala. And Hoagie, last 13 starts, 5 top 10 finishes. He's been consistently playing some really good golf. Time now for a Mass Champ chat as Tom Hoagie joins the show. Tom, George here. What's it like to be Tom Hoagie right now? Seems like you're stacking up a lot of good results week in and week out.
Hey, guys. How's it going? Just trying to show up and try to make a few birdies here. Maybe keep up with John Rahm a little bit.
Tom, you were going for your first victory on the tour last year. You're trying to do it against a guy like Jordan Spieth at a venue that's as famous and storied as Pebble Beach. How tough a challenge was it for you to hold it together on that back nine?
I felt like I had some certain, high finishes at American Express. I had played well at RSM in the fall before where I was near the lead in those situations and felt comfortable there. And that's a big thing. So I felt like I was in good shape. I felt like I was playing really well. And I hate the cliches, but it really was just one shot at a time at that point. And I really wasn't worried about who or what was going on around me.
Tom, I mean, one of the last times we chatted, we were doing the cheers to the champion, the champagne toast at Pebble Beach. And then I remember just the nerves that your wife was feeling on that back nine. Who do you think was more nervous, you or Kelly, those final nine holes as you were getting your first PGA Tour victory?
Yeah, definitely Kelly and, certainly friends and family watching all around the country as well. I felt great out there the whole day and, talking to her afterwards was a little bit harder on her and needed to find a few beverages to help it out.
Tom, no one's repeated as the winner here at the AT&T in 13 years since Dustin Johnson. We just heard from Todd Lewis, smallest greens on the PGA Tour. You lead the tour in strokes gained approach right now. That seems a pretty good recipe for a guy to win a second one.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, when I first came to Pebble Beach, I really didn't have a lot of success my first few years here. And I wouldn't say I disliked the golf course, but might have been one if the weather was bad that I'd kind of cut out of my schedule. And, you know, we played the 2019, I think, U.S. Open here. Felt like it's a golf course that really should suit my game well. You don't have to drive it that long here and just get it in play, hit a lot of good iron shots. And that really should suit me well. And, you know, the last few years I've started to play a lot better here.
Tom, you've had this fast ascension inside the top 30 now in the world golf rankings. You're 29th. You have a win on the PGA Tour. I've mentioned you have four top fives your last 13 starts. When it comes to goal setting, what's next and what's the next level you're trying to get to?
Yeah, I've never been a guy that looks at outcomes, wins, rankings, any of that sort of stuff. I've just tried to keep getting better. And as I've looked back through my career through college golf, Korn Ferry Tour, up to the PGA Tour, that I feel like I've still gotten better each year and I'm on a good trajectory and just try to put in the work each day to keep getting better.
Your season was a little up and down after you won at Pebble, Tom. You had a bunch of top tens, some missed cuts. Was there any particular reason why you kind of struggled for consistency? Were there more demands being made on your time as a PGA Tour winner? Or did your life change in any particular way that it wasn't before you had a trophy in your hand?
No, you know, it's something that I've struggled the last 2 years now as we've gone into the summer, where I just haven't hit it very well, haven't played very well. I've missed a lot of cuts in the summer. And trying to figure out why, whether I get a little bit tired, play a little bit too much, or just, you know, don't take care of my body the way that I need to as we go throughout the season. So certainly as a focus of mine this year is try and be fresh and ready to go and play well this summer as well and play well throughout the whole year.
Tom, we were just showing Max Homa wins last week at Torrey Pines, then plays a Monday skins game where he wins $400 in Papago. Are you the type of guy, you're weeks away from the PGA Tour? Do you like the action? Do you like the juice from those type of skins games?
Oh, yeah. You know, I played a club Mira Vista back home in Fort Worth, and, you know, just about every day I'm playing our scratch game out there that's $40 to get in. And, you know, we'll have two or three groups go tee it up and see who's going to win the money that day. So I like to play a lot. I like to play with a lot of different kinds of people and players and just get out and enjoy the game.
What number do you play to?
I think I'm up to about a plus seven out there these days.
You're giving seven shots to a scratch.
Makes tough, it tough to make money with that.
Makes it a little tough. Yeah.
I can only imagine. Exactly. Fortunately, you're not playing to a plus seven this week. So, Tom, enjoy your
exactly.
title defense at AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am. It was fun reliving that great final five you had last year to get your first win.
Yeah, thank you, guys. It's a lot of fun to be back, and hopefully can make some birdies this week.
Well, Larry Mize authored one of the most iconic moments in Masters history, that famous chip-in to win back in 1987. Now at age 64, Mize has announced this year will be his final competitive appearance at Augusta National. The local boy, made good, is here to talk about it when we come back.
Welcome back to Golf Today. We're just a few months away from the first men's major of the year at Augusta. 2023 Masters will be played April 6th. Through 9th, golf fans will have that seared into their memory as Live from the Masters begins on April 3rd.
Well, one of the most memorable moments in Masters history came in 1987 when 28-year-old Larry Mize crushed Greg Norman's dreams when he chipped in on the 11th hole during a playoff to win the green jacket. With the victory, Mize earned a lifetime exemption into the Masters, but this week he confirmed that the 2023 event will be his last. And he compiled an impressive record over the years, Larry Mize. He's about to make his 40th appearance. Since that win 36 years ago, he's made 20 cuts, 11 top 25 finishes, 3 top 10s, including finishing third back when Jose Maria Olazabal won in 1994. And we're pleased to be joined now by Larry Mize. Larry, thanks for joining us. You began working the scoreboard as a teenager at Augusta National. Did you ever think or allow yourself to dream that 40 years later you would leave as the owner of a green jacket?
The dreams never got quite that far. You know, I dreamed of playing in the tournament, but to dream I'd be playing in it 40 years later, no, I never did dream that.
Why is now the right time to cap it at 40, Larry?
Well, it's as you all know, it's a young man's golf course. You do not get longer as you get older. You get shorter, and the course has gotten longer. And Augusta National has done a phenomenal job of keeping up with technology and these young kids getting strong and hitting the ball so far. And the course really plays great for them, but it doesn't play great for me. So it's time for me to have my last week there, and then I'll enjoy coming back for the Champions Dinner and par three and enjoying my time.
At what point, Larry, we've seen this from a lot of great champions, even over the last decade, who've made the announcement that they're walking away. At what point for you did just making the cut on a golf course that long and difficult become a victory for the week?
Well, that's a great question. I remember when I turned 50, I still thought I could compete. I still thought I had a chance to win the golf tournament, as crazy as that may sound to some people. But as a competitor, you always believe you've got some lightning in there and something could happen. But as time went in, I started getting up in the 50s. It started to get to where the cut was the main thing. If I could make the cut and play all 4 days, it would be a nice week. So somewhere around mid, late 50s is when realizing I was going to have a hard time contending anymore.
It's been 36 years since you won the Masters. Larry, how many days in those 36 years have you managed to go without thinking about that chip-in shot?
Probably more than I should have. I probably should have thought about it more. People bring it up, and they always say, do you mind talking about this? I go, no, it's a pretty good topic for me. So, but I don't think about it every day. I move on, and I probably moved on too quickly after the Masters to try and do something after that. So, but it's always great to come back and talk to y'all and reminisce about it. And, I'm really excited about this coming April to play again.
Larry, from 84 to 94, your first 11 Masters, you made the cut every year. You had three top six finishes. Of course, you slipped on the green jacket in 87. For you, it must have been a thrill just to get to that point where you were teeing it up at the Masters. What was that run like the first decade plus that you were having that yearly tee time at Augusta?
Well, it really was great to be in contention, to have chances to win a couple of times like I did. 94 when Jose won, I played really well. Sometimes I think I played better than I did in 87. I just didn't make the putts that needed to be made, and Jose played great. But it was fun. I mean, to get to go back there every April and to be considered someone who had a chance to win was a lot of fun. And I relished that time, and it was a great 10 years for me, and just a great 10 years. I loved it.
Larry, you birdied the last hole of regulation in 1987 to get into that playoff. And there were two other guys in the playoff, Greg Norman, Seve Ballesteros. Were you conscious of the fact that you were going up against these two lions of the game and that you would have been widely perceived as the underdog in that situation?
Oh, there's no doubt. Yes, I knew that. I mean, obviously, those are two great players, and I had my hands more than full with those two. But, as a competitor, you still got to believe you can win, and you relish going up against the best players in the world. I mean, that's what I love, going up against whoever was tops. Greg and I had a six-hole playoff in the Kemper Open the previous year in 86, and on the sixth playoff, Holy beat me. So I'd been in a playoff with Greg before, which helped, and Seve and I had played a lot of golf before, and, I think we had a lot of respect for each other. So, and birdieing that last hole gave me a lot of confidence going into the playoff. I played really well all week. To birdie the 72nd hole when I needed to was really a special memory for me, as well as the chip in. So I went into the playoff with a lot of confidence and butterflies, but thank goodness they were flying in formation, so I felt pretty good.
We rank 87 as one of the best Masters all time. I mean, the back-to-back of Jack in 86 and then the finish that you had in 87 was incredible. If you could give us your short list, what would you say maybe the top three Masters finishes that you've seen, and you could obviously include yourself in 87.
Well, obviously 86, it doesn't get any better than that. I mean, to me, the greatest player of all time to win his sixth Masters at the age of 46 with his son on the bag. I mean, how can that get any better? There've been so many great ones. I can't help but think of Charles Schwartzel birdieing the last four holes to win his Masters. That was a phenomenal finish that I don't know if anybody had ever done that before as well. And another one, I guess another one you think about would be Tiger winning in 2019. If I got my years right, when he came back to win there in 2019, was an amazing win for Tiger to come back. So those are three that come to mind. I'm probably going to forget a bunch of them. There were so many. Tom Watson winning three times, and Seve, and of course, Langer's two wins were incredible when he had the lead in 95 and just went ahead and won. So, the thing about Augusta, it seemed like every year it's always special. Something about the golf course, the back nine, there's so much excitement with the water holes. It just always sets up for a phenomenal finish.
Larry, everyone you mentioned there has a place setting at the most exclusive dinner in this entire game, Tuesday night at Augusta National for the Champions Dinner. A lot of speculation this year, given the division at the top of golf with a half dozen former champions who've gone to live, some outspoken former Masters champions like Freddie, couples opposed to that. Are you in any way having some trepidation about what the vibe will be like at the dinner this year? Do you think it's going to feel any different?
Yeah, I sure hope not. It's a night that I look forward to all year, and I understand the issues there. I'm not happy with the LIV Tour. I don't think it's good for golf. Basically, let's face it, it's an exhibition tour, and they can say all they want. It's nothing more than that when you have a 54-hole tournament with no cut. And you limit it. It's an exhibition tour. It's a great exhibition tour, but it's not good for golf. So hopefully there won't be any problems that night, and we'll just have to wait and see.
You mentioned the six-hole playoff you had in 86 against Greg Norman at Kemper, and then what happened at Augusta National. So in a way, your name, Larry, is always linked to his in the history books. Has your view of Greg changed over the last couple of years, given what's going on with this division in the game?
Oh, you know, that's a great question. You know, Greg tried to do this, I think, back in 94. And I guess Greg thinks he's doing what's best in his mind. Greg and I would just disagree with that. I would respectfully disagree with him and think this is not good for the game of golf. And Arnold Palmer said it back in 94 when they started it. You know, he said Jack and Gary, they had chances to break away, and that's not in the best interest of golf. So I still stay with what Arnold says, and, you know, I just respectfully disagree with what Norman's doing.
It's always great to check in with a man who's earned the most precious trophy in this game, a green jacket. We look forward to saying goodbye a little more officially in a couple of months down the road, Larry.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. It's great to be with y'all.
Yeah, couldn't think of a better way to win the Masters and then have Jack slip on the green jacket for Larry Mize in 87. Much more still to come. We're catching up with the newly crowned champion of the Farmers Insurance Invitational. Marcus Berg joins us with more on the grind to get to this point in his career. Plus, we look ahead to his upcoming starts on the PGA Tour as you're watching Golf Today. Quite the weekend at Torrey Pines. Max Homa, a winner on Saturday. And then on Sunday, a great event took place. The fourth annual APGA Farmers Insurance Invitational 36-hole event was played Saturday and Sunday, with final round coverage airing on Golf Channel. And how about the golf we saw unfold? Marcus Berg, friend of the show, took home the title thanks to rounds of 73 and 75, riding that putter when he needed to with the victory. Berg receiving a $30,000 first place prize and an exemption into the Honda Classic late next month. Here he was closing things out on the par 5 18th. Marcus has also been named the recipient of the Charlie Sippard Memorial Exemption. We'll tee it up at the Genesis Invitational at Riviera next month. And how about this? To close it out in style. Let's get to know the man a little better. Marcus, as you see, he was the APGA Farmers Insurance Invitational champ. Like I mentioned, he played college golf at Middle Tennessee State University, was the 2019 Conference USA Player of the Year and the 2013 Georgia State Golf Association Junior Player of the Year. Probably the blink of an eye, but that was a decade ago. Now he has his eyes on a bigger prize as he joins the show here on Golf Today. Marcus, before we dive into your upcoming stint on the PGA Tour with those two starts, we got to look back to how you were able to close things out on Sunday. Now that you're a couple days removed from the win, how would you describe it to a friend?
It was a lot of fun, you know, playing one of the hardest golf courses that we play on the tour. And just being able to play in the conditions that the tour pros played on just a couple of days before that. So just was really, really excited for the challenge and just was very eager to play that golf course. It was a lot of fun, and I was very excited.
Marcus, you had a chance to win last year. Farmers Insurance Invitational stumbled late. You had a stumble on 16 this year, but then you turned around and closed it out with back-to-back birdies. Did you learn something about yourself as a competitor in those two different experiences of kind of the heartbreak and the triumph?
Absolutely. You know, I think it's huge in this game to you're going to have a lot of pain. You're going to go through some tough losses, but the most important thing is to learn from them and figure out how you can get better as a player. And I felt like I did a very good job of that this year, controlling my emotions, staying in the moment, understanding that every shot counts and that mistakes on that type of golf courses are going to happen. And I just have to live with them and move on to the next shot.
You've played one event on the PGA Tour. You now have two coming up, basically back-to-back with the Genesis Invitational and the Honda Classic. How are you going to prep yourself for being inside the ropes once again on the PGA Tour?
Just being a sponge and learning from the guys around me. I think just being around the best players in the world at the Genesis, I'll be able to pick a lot of those guys' brains and you know, just being out there and practicing with them and just being around them is definitely going to help as far as the comfort process. But most importantly, just learning and bettering my mental game for my career ahead. I think that's the biggest thing for me.
taking advantage of these opportunities, Marcus, and being a sponge, as you said, when you're around the best players in the world, practicing alongside them is one thing, but does that distract you in any way from the job at hand? Are you going to face more pressure that those 2 weeks because opportunities aren't that plentiful for you right now?
I don't think so, because I felt like that's something I did in that first event that I played in. I wanted to play very well. I wanted to take advantage of the opportunity, but I also learned that I have to enjoy the moment and enjoy being where I am and learning. And there's going to be mistakes along the way, and no one's ever just kind of jumped out there and just had automatic success. So, you know, that was something that I had to learn from, and I'm just looking forward to playing to the best that I can and learning as much as I can for these next 2 weeks.
Marcus, a lot of guys, when they're taking their first steps with life on the PGA Tour, have someone or a group of guys that they can lean on, either that they maybe competed against or at their home club, et cetera, or maybe out on tour. Is there anyone that you can seek counsel with, just to, if you have anything to bounce off of them as you're readying yourself to tee it up at the Genesis Invitational?
Yeah, the first guy that comes to mind is Billy Horschel. You know, he's been such a huge support over the last 2 years. He was the first guy to text me saying congratulations after I won this event and when I received the exemption. So we're going to play a practice round that Tuesday when I get there. And he's just been a huge support system for me and just someone who I can trust and just kind of pick his brain on things. And I definitely think I'm looking forward to spending some time with him this week.
Marcus, back when you were a kid, Tiger Woods was playing the Congressional close to where you were living at the time. You tried to get a picture signed by Tiger. You struck out that day. Are you going to bring it to the locker room at Riviera and ask him to sign it all these years later?
No, man. I definitely want to, like I told my dad, one day I want him to sign my scorecard. So, you know, I'm not really going to ask for autographs. I'm definitely going to pick his brain and learn as much as I can. But I do want that to come to fruition. One day I want us to be playing in the same event and hopefully in the same group. So, you know, that's just a goal that I have in mind that I set out to achieve. And I'm looking forward to the process to get to that point.
Well, it'll be hard to miss the guy on the first tee at Riviera next month. So it's going to be a special experience with him watching on as you get things going at the Genesis Invitational. Marcus, thanks for the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, coming up next, Paul McGinley has often said he wanted to see the Rory McIlroy of his youth. He shoved everyone out of the way on his way to own this game. Is that what we're finally seeing again now? We'll talk to Paul about that and a few other topics right after the break. We're pleased to add a little more Irish to the show today and welcome in Paul McGinley, player, analyst, Ryder Cup captain. Paul, we've had this conversation a few times over the years where you wanted to see more of the Rory McIlroy of his youth, the kid with the pointy elbows, as you called it, who came out and stomped all over everyone and said, I now own this game. Are you seeing more of that now than you did maybe a couple of years ago?
There's no question, Eamon, about that. Absolutely no question at all. I think, you know, I've been saying it for a year now, or since it happened about 18 months ago, since he started seeing Bob Rachallo and Brad Faxon, he has gone to a different level as a player and a competitor. Certainly, you just look at what he's done with Brad with his putting. Obviously, the statistics will bear fruit on that. But also look where he is mentally as well, too. I think we're seeing a stronger edition of McIlroy than we've ever seen before. There's no element of his game that you consider weak now. Statistics will back that up. And I love the fire in his belly. And, you know, since Liv have come on the scene, I think it's collided with the work he's doing with Bob Rachallo. And I think they've cultivated that noise from Liv and turn it into a very positive influence on Rory.
So, Paul, you're saying mentally it's arguably the strongest version of Rory we're seeing. If you think maybe his physical gifts in 2014 and the run he had there was maybe the best stretch we've seen out of Rory when he pocketed two majors, how close do you think his game is now to what we saw back then?
I think it's better, George. You know, my view, very simplistic view, would be that when he burst on the scene, the competition wasn't as strong as it is now. And I think that he's, you know, now in a much different, more difficult environment in terms of competitors around him. And I think your game has to be better. I think his game is certainly better. There's no weaknesses in it. But mentally, he's on a different level. And all that expectation that's come with him for over the last 10 years, where we've all talked about how talented he is and how brilliant he is. You know, he's now delivering on that level of expectation on his shoulders. And it's a very, very difficult thing to do. And that's why I say, I think this is the best edition we've seen of Rory McIlroy.
You mentioned, Paul, all the noise about LIV Golf last year, how he kind of processed that as fuel. Are you at all concerned about the comment he made early last week where he said he kind of put the clubs away at the end of the year because he was exhausted by all of that noise around him?
I wouldn't be concerned about it at all. Everybody's got to refresh no matter what they're doing, no matter what job they're in. And he would have done that. And as I say, he would have come out. I'm sure he's had a number of conversations with Bob Rotella since then. And you know, he hit the ground running last week. I don't think he had his A game with him last week. Again, statistics will show you that. But again, he's won with his B and C game. And that's a criticism that we would have been leveling at him in years past that, yeah, you know, when he's on his game, he's the best. But too often his game is B and C and he doesn't compete. Now, as we saw last week, and we saw in Vegas last year as well too, where he led the putting stats to win, that now he doesn't have to have his A game in order to win. And I think early in his career, he was so dominant because he was technically better than anybody else. And I think now he's getting up there with mentally as strong, if not stronger than anybody else in the game, on top of that, you know, brilliant game that he has tee to green, and now with the putter as well.
Speaking of LIV, Patrick Reed, the runner-up by a single shot, he's among those players currently permitted to play on the DP World Tour due to the stay-on suspensions imposed until the case comes before arbitration sports service resolutions in the UK on February 6th. Phil Mickelson quoting The Guardian today, thinking that the outcome will be positive for LIV, which you would anticipate as a LIV player. What do you anticipate potentially unfolding, and how would kind of an assimilation period occur if that comes to fruition?
Yeah, I mean, look, at this moment in time, LIV are winning because the players can come back and play on the DP World Tour like we saw last week. And winning that tribunal that they did last summer was a huge thing for them. They didn't win it in America, obviously, and they're not able to play on the PGA Tour. But winning in Europe is a win for them at the moment because they're able to play LIV in their $20 million purses every week plus their sign-on fees and come back and dip into our biggest prize funds whenever it suits them. So at this moment in time, it's a big win for LIV. So don't be surprised if there is no clear-cut resolution here. I'm hoping there is one way or the other so we can all move on. But, you know, don't be surprised. You know, a win also for LIV could be if this thing is delayed for another 6 months or 9 months, or, you know, there's so much shade thrown on things that, you know, it's going to take a lot longer version and a deeper court case to get to the bottom of it. So that could happen as well. So there's three different scenarios there could happen: a win, a lose, or maybe a deferral down the road. And in two of those scenarios, you know, the LIV players will win where they can still continue to play, as they say, on DP World Tour. So let's just see how that pans out. Where it's going to go in the future, if LIV were to win the case, bearing in mind it is going to be binding, again, there's so much conjecture and there's so much on the table there about what we do, where we go, what the DP World will do. I mean, you know, that's a huge decision to make going forward if they are to win. And there's some radical things they could do, you know, such as changing the constitution, reconstitute the tour and start again, rewrite the rules. Or, you know, they'll embrace the guys back and play with them. Or, you know, I don't know what other options than those two they would have should they go on and lose. But obviously, you know, DP World Tour will have a different view than Phil's there. And they will think that their lawyers feel that they've got a very, very strong case. And obviously are very disappointed we lost the tribunal in the first place and are keen now to rectify things and win this tribunal next month.
Three of the guys from LIV who played in the Hero Dubai Championship last weekend, Paul, finishing the top 10. Obviously, Patrick Reed, the runner-up. Stenson, who was stripped of the Ryder Cup captaincy, and Ian Poulter. Is there a hardening of sentiment among players when they see guys, as you said, double dip by coming back from LIV to play in the Rolex Series events with the premier purses out there?
I think there is, and I've been around the tour, you know, quite a bit, and certainly the players that I speak to and the people that I'm around and the caddies and the coaches and, you know, and I'm not going to talk definitively of every single person, but what I'm saying is that the majority of people will have a view to say, look, lads, you're lucky enough to absolutely hit the golden goose on the head and get paid tens of millions and sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars to go off and play for 14 times a year for $20 million in a limited field. And you've hit the financial jackpot. If you make a decision to leave the collective and go over there, that's fine. I get you. I'm not going to judge you on it. But don't expect to come back then and take money off the table from the tour that you left behind. And bearing in mind as well, Eamon, and this is a big thing, particularly when it comes to Europe, they have stolen tournaments off the European Tour, off the DP World Tour, that they've now put on LIV or put on the Asian Tour. So they're actively now working against us. They're actively working against the tour in terms of taking away not just Valderrama, one of our venues very synonymous with the DP World Tour and all the history of Ryder Cup. They're taking away venues and they're taking away tournaments and putting it on their schedule and actually hurting us, our business model. So why are we not in a position as a DP World Tour to protect that model? You know, and players can't ride two horses here. You know, you ride one or the other. And that'd be my view at the very start. And it's still a view very strongly now. And if the guys are going off, off you go. And from the people that I've spoke to, like I say, players, caddies, coaches, they would all have that view. And that view would be off you go, guys. Good luck. Go and play for your money. But don't expect to come back and take money off the table and places in the tournaments for young guys from Challenge Tour and the qualifying school. They're not getting into tournaments because you're coming back and playing for our biggest events.
The other players not only would have noticed Reid, for instance, taking a spot in the field or getting the world ranking points or finishing second and taking that prize money, they would have also paid attention to what happened during the third round with the rules issue that came up. What was your read on that situation?
Look, the evidence looks quite clear that it went in a different three than he said he saw his ball in. But like a lot of things that it comes to the rules with Patrick Reid, and I saw your comments yesterday about him, you know, running out of credit with everybody. And you know, I'll take that argument. You'd have to agree with it. So many times there's conjecture around this guy. But the bottom line is it cannot be, unless it's 101% definitive, that there was, you know, something wrong went on in terms of his behavior there. I think it's very hard to level the blame on him. And it has to be 100% when it comes to something like this. And everything we do, from the bunker situation over in Bahamas or whether it was the three yesterday, it looks like for 98% that it went in a different tree than what he said it went in, but it's not 100%. And when you're dealing with something like that, you know, it's got to be 100%. So there's always that little get out clause that he's had so far. But, you know, he's going to run out of runway. There's eventually something's going to happen if this continues. But, you know, certainly the evidence that I saw on TV and slowing down the golf ball as it went into the tree, it's quite clear it went into a different tree than what he said. But again, it's not 100%. And while it's not 100%, it's difficult to level the blame 100% at him.
And like Eamon mentioned, he's one of three LIV players who are among the top 10 at the Hero Dubai Desert Classic. If you're just a fan of the DP World Tour, you see a leaderboard like last week with all these big names and the possibility that if the LIV players lose in arbitration, they wouldn't be part of the DP World Tour going forward. Do you think that hurts the golf fan at all?
It does. Of course, it does hurt the golf fan, because when you don't have the top players playing together collectively all the time, of course, you know, our product is diluted, George, you know, and that's what LIV has done. It's diluted the product of golf. And, you know, you want the top players playing against each other more and more and more. But let's go back to the very, very basics of what professional golf is. And it's the same principle in Europe as it is in America. And basically what happened 50 years ago and a little bit longer in PGA Tour's case is group of professional golfers came together and said, we can play this game quite well. We want to join together, put all of our skill sets together, work as a collective, almost like a trade union. And we're going to be better and stronger if we're represented all together. Then they employ executives to go out and sell and make a tour. Now, that has evolved over the tour to the multi-billion dollar business that it is now. But what's happened is these guys have left the collective. So when you leave the collective, they're leaving the collective weaker. And you know, although at this moment in time, the PGA Tour riding the storm and they have some money just as well they do, and they have some money on account that they can override the storm here. But you can bet your bottom dollar when negotiations are coming up with sponsors or TV companies or whatever it is in 3 or 4 or 5 years' time, if LIV is still going, that collective is going to be a lot, the value of that collective is going to be a lot weaker than it was while LIV wasn't on the pitch. And you know, surely the tours have got a right to say, okay, if the new rules are in play, well, that's fine. But the players cannot come back and double dip and play both of those. We're not saying they can't have competition in professional golf, but if you're going to have competition, well, surely we can play by our rules and we can protect our business and do what's right to make our business stronger.
Before we let you go, Paul, there was some player caddy news overnight. Shane Lowry, who you know quite well, split with his caddy, Beau Martin, after I think probably 5 years. Those guys have been together, including that epic win at Royal Portrush in the Open back in 2019. What do you make of this change?
Yeah, I mean, it's it's some ways it's expected, in other ways it's disappointing. I think Bo is a brilliant caddy. He's been around a long time. I think he's the perfect caddy in a lot of ways for Shane Lowry. We saw the success he had, not just in the Open, but how well Shane played last year, where he really moved to be considered now, you know, one of the elite players on the PGA Tour with his consistency. And then he won so dominantly in Wentworth, our biggest tournament of the year, back last September. So it's disappointing. Shane wears his heart on his sleeve, and, you know, and Bo wears his heart on his sleeve. And often, you know, two personalities like that are going to collide every now and again. Maybe the best thing for them, two boxes, is just separate them for a time. Let them have a break away from each other. Because what has happened over the years is they've turned from being, you know, employer and employee and working on those terms into very, very strong friendships as well, too, where they spent a lot of time socially together. And sometimes the lines can get blurred when that's happened. And when that happens, it's not that a friendship is broken. It means that, look, let's just separate for a while. Let's reassess things and maybe review things again in a number of months' time later. And that well could be the case. But for the short term, Shane is looking for a new caddy. I had a chat with him this morning about some ideas and some caddies and what you want. He's obviously ringing around people that he wants to get an opinion from and garnering his own opinion. And when his time is right, he'll make his decision. So he's a great guy. He's a great player. And, you know, things will work out. They always do. These player caddy relationships break up all the time. They kiss and make up sooner or later, though, Eamon.
Could just be goodbye for now, according to Paul McGinley. Enjoy the chat,
It could
Paul.
Be. You never know. It could be. All right, guys. Thanks very much. Keep up the good work.
Back at it on Golf Today. This week, the PGA Tour returns to one of its most iconic venues. You can catch live first-round coverage of the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern right here on Golf Channel. Some of the notable names for the fans to follow this week. Jordan Spieth, a stalwart that we see year in and year out at the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am. Matt Fitzpatrick, Justin Rose, Seamus Power, a winner earlier this season on the PGA Tour. Kevin Kisner, also in the mix. Remember, in the 2021 edition of the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am, Stanford standout Maverick McNealy had his best finish on the PGA Tour. Found himself one shot off the lead on the 72nd hole, played that great second into the par 5 18th, would ultimately finish runner-up by two to Daniel Berger, who took home the title. So for more on Maverick, let's welcome in Todd Lewis. T-Lew, you had a chance to catch up with Maverick today. Seems like his game is certainly trending in the right direction coming into this week.
Yeah, you're right, George. Each and every year he's been on the PGA Tour, he has elevated his status, and he has quite a bit of connectivity to the Monterey Peninsula. He grew up in Northern California. His family would summer here on the peninsula, and at the age of 16, his family bought him a tee time at Pebble Beach, and he played a wonderful round of golf that was borderline religious. I mean, why wouldn't it be? It's Pebble Beach. His grandparents actually still live in Carmel, not too far down the road. He's staying with them this week. As a matter of fact, Maverick bragged to me just a few moments ago the fact that his grandmother made him his favorite French toast breakfast this morning. He's a favorite heading into, or one of the favorites, I should say, heading into this week. Why? Because not only has he played well here, but he's playing well in regards to just about every tournament he's played. He's got three top 10 so far, but he has a one on the PGA Tour, and he would like to change that here this week. And I asked him how impactful it would be if he's able to cross the finish line and win here at Pebble.
That would be so much fun. There's two games. The first game is to get yourself in the second game, and then the second one is just to get yourself over the line and get that trophy. And there is no better feeling in the world than executing a golf shot when it really matters. I mean, I think back to finishing second here and the drive I hit on 18 and the approach shot I hit on 18, just the feeling of the ball coming off and knowing it's perfect. There's really nothing else like it. And so I would just love the opportunity to get in that position, hole a big putt, hit a perfect shot, and I'd just be so excited to be there.
Final thing, you're not too far away from having your pilot's license. We have talked about that over the last month or so. Why is it important for you to do that? What drew you to getting into the cockpit?
So a bunch of things. It all really started when I was paired with George McNeil. I call him Uncle George, at the 3M this year, and he flew himself 20 years on tour, and I was peppering him with questions. I've always been, you know, staring up at the sky, but I've loved the process. Like, again, it's a process thing. I'm doing it a little slower because I'm traveling a bunch and I don't get to fly as much as I might want, but the process of being fully focused and invested, when I'm up in the air, I'm not thinking about anything else, and it's a wonderful thing. It pushes me, it challenges me, pushes me outside my comfort zone at times. And I've found that my ability to focus, my ability to process a lot of information and just have a ton of fun up there has gotten a lot better. And I've applied things that make me a good golfer to flying, and I've learned a lot of things in flying that I think have helped me prepare better for big moments in golf as well.
Such as?
Well, first solo was a big learning experience. The first time you go up without an instructor, and it was just three laps around the traffic pattern, three takeoffs and landings, and it's kind of, there's an oh crap moment when you pull back on that stick and you're like, okay, I'm up in the air and there's only one person in this plane that can land it, and that's me. The night before, I sat there and I did what's called, you know, by one of my friends who flies F-35s, calls chair flying. You just sit in a chair and you visualize everything you're going to do. And I did that for an hour, probably 10 laps of the pattern in my head, every radio call, every checklist item, just did it over and over and over again. And when I got on the runway for my first solo, I wasn't nervous at all. I was just excited and completely focused, and runway heading matches the heading bug, and engine instruments are green, put in the power, right rudder, and you go. So it was just automatic, and I want to apply that to how I prepare for golf tournaments too.
Now, Maverick has been through the written part of getting his pilot license. Now he's got a little more time in the cockpit to spend before he finally gets his license, and that is 4 hours in the cockpit, 2.5 hours solo. And if he does that, then he will officially become a pilot in regards to, being able to fly himself all over the world on the PGA Tour. He's going to take Honda off to prepare for that final test, and he plans to take his final test the week of the Arnold Palmer Invitational. Coincidentally, Mr. Palmer may be the most famous golfer who had a pilot's license as well. I can tell you, Maverick Neely has a lot of depth as a person. He is submerged in confidence and humility. It seems like it's inevitable that he is going to win on the PGA Tour. Guys, it might happen this week.
And Todd, we were talking in our pre-show meeting. You have a conversation with Maverick McNeely. It's completely atypical to what you normally see walking up and down the range on the PGA Tour. Let's welcome in Paige McKenzie. I mentioned to Todd, his game's trending in the right direction. Paige, is there one aspect of his game where you've seen improvement?
Yeah, and what you and Todd are both alluding to as it relates to trending is not just this season where he's performed very well, but over the last 3 years in the PGA Tour, went from 68th, 58th, 38th on the FedEx Cup the last 3 years, now sits 26th. And a lot of it has to do with putting, to answer your question. When you look at what he's done over the last couple of years and continuing to improve, those incremental improvements. Had a good season in 2019-2020. That was the COVID-shortened year. But then over the last couple of years, strokes gained putting went from 83rd to 19th to 2nd. Now look specifically at that strokes gained number. Between last year and this year, he has gained a full stroke per round over his finishes last year, where he was ranked inside the top 20. So there's an even larger distribution of strength in his putting at the very, very top end where he sits right now. Again, still early part of the season, but significant improvements with the putting that's been a leader in his game, specifically the short putts, third on the PGA Tour, inside 10 feet. So a big part of why he's been successful so far this year. But George, I want to go back to what we were talking about in this pre-show meeting where we're talking about Maverick McNeely. A lot of it has to do with his background. He dissects things. We heard him talking about becoming a pilot, but this is somebody that was an engineering student in college. He was management, science, and engineering at Stanford. So you can understand that his brain maybe ticks a little differently. Has talked about how over the offseason, he was trying to get 1% better, working on a glucose monitoring system where he was wearing that, trying to figure out where his blood sugar levels were throughout the day, as well as sleep and recovery, trying to just check off all of those little boxes to be better. So maybe no surprise that we're seeing improvement this year.
Paige, I'm curious if you think there's a weight of expectation that was perhaps unfairly placed on Maverick McNeely. He was the number one ranked amateur in the world. He put in a great record when he was playing at Stanford, earned comparisons to Tiger Woods' record in college at the time. When you get out on tour, it's a lot harder to get success out there than it might seem. from a distance. Do you think he's a victim of unfair expectations that were heaped on too early?
To some extent, yes. I mean, we see the players that come out immediately and have success, and it just looks effortless. But the reality is the game slightly changes when you come on tour. Greens are slightly firmer. Pins are tucked a little closer. The rough's a little bit longer. The penalties for the errors that you make are harder. And I think for most players, they go through that progression. And there's no reason to complain about what he's been able to do so far on tour. But, yeah, you see the high flyer stories of the Jordan Spieths that come out and immediately win. But for Maverick McNealy, it's taken a very stable growth path since he's been on the PGA Tour. But certainly, yes, the expectations from college golfers that come out as one of the top ones are there. And that was certainly the case for Maverick McNealy.
Yeah, you wonder if once he breaks through, if he's going to rip off a few victories. And as golf today rolls on, we saw that with Max Homa. Took the 2013 NCAA Men's Individual Champ out of Cal a little bit to finally get his first one on the PGA Tour. Now he has a six-pack. His sixth tour win coming last week at the Farmers Insurance Open. His swing coach, Mark Blackburn, going to join the program next. Give us the secret sauce to the key to the 13th-ranked player in the world's game. Next. Look at the trajectory of the career of Max Homa. You see he got his start all the way back in 2013. 105 total starts from 2013 to 2020, just 8 top 10s. His first win was the Wells Fargo Championship. Since then, wow, he has kicked it into gear. 51 starts, 13 top 10s, 5 wins, and has gone from a best world ranking of 68th all the way up to 13th.
Well, Max Homa began working with PGA professional Mark Blackburn back in 2020. That was the same year that Mark won the National PGA of America Coach of the Year honors. Homa now has 6 PGA Tour victories to his resume, following his most recent in the Farmers Insurance Open. And Mark joins us now. Mark, when you look at the progress you've made in the 3 years you've worked with Max Homa to where he is now, what part of that progress are you most proud of?
I think that he's taken a strength, he's made driving a huge strength, and that was something that he struggled with. He's always been a phenomenal iron player, an incredible putter, and then he's now got the ability to put the ball in play. And as you saw on Saturday, he's driving on really hard golf courses where he's won quite a few tournaments now is fantastic. And I think that's really put him in the upper echelon of players, and that's one of the things I'm proudest of, just because he wants to understand and learn why certain things happen, and he has a really inquisitive mind. So for me as a coach, he's kind of like the dream student.
When you work with a player who's trying to establish himself on tour market, they've had the game to get out there, and then they see what exists between them and the level that they want to get to next among the elite players. Is there a danger that they can kind of go too far and try to lose essentially the skills that got them there? Is it a process of managing a guy along that process rather than him trying to just run headlong into it?
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, remember, you don't want to take somebody's strength and make that a weakness at the effort to improve a weakness, right? You've got to keep their core competencies and their strengths and the things that make them great. And then the advantage of doing this quite a long time now is you can nurture, sort of cultivate, look, these are the things that are going to have the biggest impact on your game, no pun intended, and this is where we need to focus. And thanks to analytics and things like Strokes Gained now, us as the coaches have the ability to really pinpoint where some of the deficiencies are, where the strengths are, and then how do we sort of work around that and capitalize on making the player the best version of themselves.
We hear on broadcast certain players are field players. They have some artistry to their game. Other guys are much more technical. They like repetition and something that they can rely on. What would you say is Max's strength? Where does he fit in the equation?
It's a great point. I think the best players are a blend of each, right? They play like an artist, but they prepare in a technical manner that allows them the latitude to just play golf, you know, see the target, see ball, hit ball. But the preparation that goes into that, Max is a wonderful combination because he wants to understand technically to really sort of master the ingredients to his recipe and then go on when he plays golf. He wants to be able to, you know, hit the shot that he and Joe see on the golf course and really sort of feel that, so to speak, not think about internally what he's doing, but very much externally pick on the target, see the shot, visualize it, and then go be able to execute. So I think you want to be a blend of each. And then as a coach, you have to adapt to the player, right? We have to be a bit of a chameleon and then figure out what's the best way to connect with the player. How do they respond best? And for Max, he really likes that sort of practical approach of tell me what the issue is. Okay, why is this happening? What do we need to do to fix that? And then how do I go about doing it? And then very much he makes it his own. And then, you know, when they're on the golf course, they're all geniuses. That's why their name's on the bag and I have a PGA Tour card. So my job is to get them ready so they can go be the artist.
How much of Max's success right now owes to the mental game work he's been doing as well? Because he did have a reputation earlier in his career of being quite hard on himself. Now he seems remarkably relaxed in his own skin.
Yeah, I would say, like, I always have put him as very stoic. You never know what's going on the inside. And I think that's one of the things that makes people great in the heat of battle as a competitor, right? Like, they're so resilient and they can navigate anything. But I think, to your point, he was also very hard on himself and he's a perfectionist by nature. And sometimes that's just hard to live up to in your own self. And then he's done some great work at the end of last year into this year with Julie Elion, and they've done a great job. And I think he seems a lot more content in himself, but, you know, being a father now, fatherhood, he's playing for his son and his wife. Things get a little different. I'm a parent myself. So I think that perspective is also a little different, but he's definitely embracing the sort of mindset of, okay, my brain and the way I play golf, that's something that I can really tap into, because he's reaching, you know, kind of the peak of how much more can he do to get better physically as it relates to his golf swing. Last week, he was number one strokes gained approach. Like, hard to get better than that. So it's one of those things. He's looking in every area because the goal is, as a team, we want to get him to the number one player in the world.
Was just going to ask about goal setting, and you just said he was number one strokes gained approach. He would like to get to number one in the world. For the average fan at home, it would just seem like maintenance when he's coming off a week like that. Could you kind of let us peek under the hood, coming off a win? What can you possibly be working on?
Yeah, it's a great point. So if you think about the golf course he just played, is Torrey Pines. We had a US Open there recently. It's a really hard, big golf course, and he thrives on those conditions. So I think this is great moving forwards to going into Augusta and then LACC, Royal Liverpool, like Oak Hill, all these major golf courses this year. It's one of the things where, look, it was a really good week. Now it's on to the next tournament. What do I need to do to prepare to play well? He's going to be playing at Phoenix next week, which is a home event, and then obviously on to Riviera, where he's had some success. So to get to the number one player in the world, every week is like a new week. You start again, and then how do I navigate the golf course based on my skill sets? What do I need to do? And the goal being, are you able to hit good golf shots under pressure when it really, really matters? And how comfortable can you be being uncomfortable in those big situations? And he's really thriving on that. So that's where we're going. That's what we're trying to do. Just prepare him as a team with everybody that's on his team, get our guy ready to play the best golf he possibly can. And it's just, you know, trying to get a little bit better here and there. Obviously, his good is really, really good. It's just getting that really, really good at the right time so he can capitalize and shoot the lowest score possible at one of the four majors, or hopefully all of them this year.
Well, you said he has to be comfortable in the uncomfortable. His next start at the Phoenix Open will be like playing golf on Mars, with it being the Phoenix Open and the Super Bowl that week in Phoenix. So it's going to be a fun watch. And I was looking forward to the conversation with you and what you and Max have been working on. So I appreciate you sharing that with us.
Absolutely.